It works.
Nice.
The House Committee on, or no, sorry, I saw him. I was confused.
He is confusing, you know.
Yeah.
Look who comes strolling in.
Let's try that again. The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order.
That new gavel's got you confused.
It does.
It's beautiful.
It does. My daughter made me a gavel in wood shop for Mother's Day, which is probably the best Mother's Day gift I have ever gotten, and another reason why we should have more CTE in our schools.
All right.
Go for that. You guys wouldn't let her go.
Darn Democrats. All right. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2394 and invite Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2394A requires a state lottery to inform the Department of Human Services within 7 days of paying a lottery prize of $12.50 or more. It declares emergency as effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal, no subsequent referral, and it left the both House committees and the House floor all unanimous.
It's always a surprise.
Thank you very much. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I am state representative out of the Albany area. And the rest of you will not recall this. Ms. Ross will remember it, but Madam Chair, you'll remember it, that a couple years ago in Human Services over on the other side, we had submitted 8 bills that dealt with different issues involving the supplemental or the public assistance programs. And as a result of that, none of the bills moved, but it was really a good thing what we did as a result of that, because Carolyn Tomei, who was the chair at that time, and myself convened a work group to review all this stuff. And this is a copy of what that is. And yours truly, Jill Gray from Department of Human Services, put this together for us. But we met several different times then. As a result of that, the bill that you're looking at right now, 2394, is a piece of the recommendations from that work group as we meet. So let me just kind of share just quickly. It does come to you from the House Committee on Judiciary, and it was passed unanimously there as well as on the House floor. Basically, in 2013, the Secretary of State's audit released a audit regarding the public assistance programs, which revealed $2.8 million of inaccurate payments. So that's a lot of what drove us to get to where we were at with this work group, too. It was discovered that 251 Oregon lottery winners with winnings of more than $5,000 received food stamps, including one person who won more than $900,000. So in conjunction with the audit and the federal level, the farm bill that was passed, which required states with gaming agencies to close the policy loophole and encourage states to set up a data match program to identify and close the cases of substantial lottery winners, got us to this point right now. And so really what it is just trying to bring some communications now from the lottery to Department of Human Services, because they have done, honestly, you know, not to blow their horn or anything like that, but Jill and her colleagues have done an outstanding job with dealing with public assistance programs, especially SNAP as well as TANF. They're concerned about program integrity, and this is another step toward securing the integrity of what they're interested in, as well as I think we would be here too in this building.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I do have a question. So, Andy, it's great to see you. And
thank you, Senator.
You can go back.
So the lottery will inform DHS, and you know, what do you see as the next step from that? You know, as you know, in terms of what the effect would be. You know, say someone won $1,000. You know, what kind of impact will that have on their SNAP benefits or TANF or whatever?
Well, okay, so Julie, but I appreciate, you know, Madam Chair, Senator Denbrough, what you just asked the question about $1,000, because actually the limit is at $12.50 that would require lottery to report that. But I'll let Jill fill in on that.
Sure. I'm Jill Gray. I'm one of the legislative coordinators for the Department of Human Services. And so the bill would be an information sharing, you're correct, between the department and lottery.
Jill, can you pull the microphone a little closer, please? Thank you.
for people who have lottery winnings over $1,250. So when there is someone who has won over that threshold amount, this bill would require the department to do a determination of whether that person, if it affects their eligibility for SNAP. That will depend on household size, other eligibility factors. So simply winning doesn't mean that that person would lose eligibility, but rather we would have to take a look at that person's financial requirements and determine if this would put them over the financial eligibility requirements. I think one of the questions you may be asking, Senator Dembro, is could there be someone who loses eligibility but then maybe reapplies in a short amount of time? And the answer is yes, that could happen.
Yeah. And if I could follow up. Yeah. So the $1,250 windfall that they receive would that be sort of added to their weekly wages, or this is something that, or would it be averaged out over a year, or, how exactly would it be calculated? Because, presumably they're not going to be a winner every week.
Right.
I think.
If so, I want to get to know them better.
Yes, absolutely.
Chair Gelder and Senator Dembro, it's an excellent question, and actually it's something that I would have to go back and ask about, because you're getting down into the weeds of determining eligibility, that there are differences between income and resources. And what I think you're getting to is this going to be considered income or rather a resource? And I'm going to have to get back to you on that.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. And I did sign on to this because the way that the good representative presented it sounded very reasonable at the time.
Well, he's big.
His arm's been recovered.
Yeah.
Since
and then. I think he got Cruz and me at the same time. So,
Senator Cruz, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah. But this basically is complying with federal law doing this.
Chair Gelder and Senator Cruz, you're correct.
Yeah.
This is something that is in the Farm Bill.
Right.
So
right.
It's a direction from Congress.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there are federal funds in play here if we don't comply, I would assume. I mean, potentially, but I would assume that might be a one way to look at it.
Chair Gelder and Senator Cruz, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you are correct that actually part of the cost of doing the information sharing between the department and lottery, that there can be some federal dollars used for that. Again, mm-hmm. I will
That's right.
confirm that. And thank you, Representative Olson confirmed it. So there we go.
Thank you very much. Is it,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, affirmative.
Senator Olson. See, now you understand why I keep calling you Representative Olson.
I get it. We're both good looking.
Issue.
Yeah, they look
both
so much looking. Alike.
Question I have. I don't have any SNAP accounts. I don't have any TANF bills, or I don't have anything. Don't have anything to do with DHS. I win. You get my information. Why should you have my information, and how long do you keep it?
Chair Gelder, Senator Olson, so let me see if I'm understanding the question. You're not in this hypothetical situation. You're not receiving any public assistance.
Absolutely, yes.
Benefits from the department.
Right.
Then we would not know anything about you.
But this bill says you have to get my Social Security number and my name and all this pertinent information. The Department of Human Services, the director of the Oregon State Lottery shall notify the Department of Human Services of the name of the prize recipient, the Social Security number of the recipient, any other available identifying information about the recipient, and the amount of the prize paid to the recipient. So I'm not on any public assistance whatsoever, and you're going to get my name and information, Social Security number included, which is very critical to my identity.
So
why do you
I
have it in hand, and how long will you have it in hand?
Those are 1 month.
No, it's worth. We're calling our friend.
I think you're trying to say, because I was going to ask too, that how will the lottery will have to report to DHS, so how does the lottery know that that particular person is a DHS recipient?
Right, which is, yeah, follows along the same line.
And if they don't know, then does that mean every lottery winner is going to be reported to
DHS? Well, according to this bill, they have every lottery winner has to be reported.
Only if it's
my understanding, okay, Madam Chair and right. Senator Olson, and maybe Ms. Ross can correct me on this, but the way I understand the way the bill is written, with the statute, it's specifically designed for Department of Human Services in connection with the SNAP program.
But it doesn't say that. It's, although it does say the Agricultural Act, but it also says within 7 days of paying a prize of $1,250, they have to provide DHS with information. So
okay.
Then the question is, how do they know if I'm on a SNAP program or any DHS program, unless asked? And if they don't know, then the Department of Lottery is going to have to send over my information to you, which I particularly don't want you to have. And I'm not saying that in, you know, any mean-spirited way. It's just that the more my information is disseminated, the more people call me Andy Olson.
With a E-N.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'll get back to you specifically on that, but I would venture to almost say, as I dig into this, that the Agricultural Act, the Farm Bill, will reflect specifically what this is about, and that's what we're referring to. So
follow up. So then, if someone won, would the question be first asked, do you have a SNAP card or do you have an EBT card or whatever, or can they even ask that question?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's not even going to be part of the process of this. It will be a communication device between what's happening with who is right now on the program in connection with from DHS to lottery.
Well, I guess the follow up again. I guess the question would be, how would lottery know if they were on the program unless DHS sent over a list and said these people are on the program? And when lottery sees that list, they go, we've identified somebody on the program to go back. Because otherwise, you're going to pick up hundreds of thousands of people, not me, because I don't win diddly squat, but you're going to pick up hundreds of thousands of people that are going to win this and not be on any public assistance program, and you're going to have a file filled with names of people that aren't on assistance. And so the question is, how long do you keep it, and why do you have it in the first place?
Chair Gelzer and Senator Olson, an excellent question, and we'll have to get back to you on more of the process details for it. I'll just point out that there has to be information sharing at some point.
I agree with that.
And for the SNAP program, there are still over 700,000 people who are SNAP recipients. So it probably does make more sense that the department receives lottery winners rather than sharing who all of the SNAP recipients are with lottery. Mm-hmm. But Representative Olson and I, we will provide more information
Thank
about
you.
How the process works.
Follow-up comment. I do agree with the fact that we need to ferret out those people that have large winnings and don't report that mm-hmm. they've won. I agree with you wholeheartedly. My concern is for those people that aren't part of the program.
Yes.
What?
I would think
Senator Cruz?
I think it'd be very simple, because that does make sense that you would get the winners, and if they aren't in your program, you just delete the information. You know, but we may need to spell that out.
Okay.
So, and then I just have a question. Will there be a particular person that's identified where they get an email, like a secure email that says Andy Olson, Social Security number 555555555?
How'd you know his number?
Really smart. Just won $2,000, and then they look in the list to see if there is an Andy Olson with that number. Is that?
Yes. Chair Gelzer, you are. That's pretty much the process. Is that we need a name and a Social Security number to try and make mm-hmm. sure it is the same person who is receiving benefits and has won lottery winnings. And then if that happens, as we said, we'll have to get some more details on how the process will work. But you're correct that there would be some type of notification if it were the same person that they had won over the threshold amount, and that there would be. It may impact their benefits.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
Would the Lottery Commission have access to your files? No?
No. Not for this part of the information sharing.
Right. Well, I the reason I make that comment, it would be just so easy for them to access your files and look. Instead of you sending over 700,000 names, that they could just access your files and look. Or maybe you can make, put a common file where they can look at it. But I'm concerned for individuals that aren't part of the program that their information is going out to an agency they have no need to be in.
So I think what I've heard is that Jill and the good representative are going to get back to us. If I understand your question, it's a privacy-related question.
Right.
A person not receiving benefits, will their information go to DHS? How will DHS handle and dispose of that information? And you're going to send that back to us. Senator Vonna Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would want to make sure that we are not treating people in DHS any differently than we treat those people who are winning lotteries. So if someone wins $1,250, how do we know they're not reporting that as income to the IRS? See, there could be a discrimination piece here, and I'm concerned about that. We're worried about them winning a whole lot of money of $1,250, and then there's another person who's not on DHS and wins $1,250. Are we going to be examining or making sure that the IRS and the Oregon Revenue, that they're paying taxes on that $1,250? Now, maybe that's not an issue, but to me it seems like hopefully we're treating everyone fairly on this.
And Senator Monis Anderson, maybe that is some information that you can bring back. What notification does the Lottery Commission make to the Department of Revenue in terms of truing that up? I think that there is that type of notification from several years on the Revenue Committee, but maybe if you could bring that information back too, that would be really helpful, especially if you could send it ahead of time so people can read it before we come back. Any final questions? I know that we are kind of holding up the entire House Judiciary Committee right now.
Yeah, they can't take a joke.
All right. Thank you very, very much. It's come back and see us again.
He goes, yeah, right.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2394 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2629A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2629A directs the owner of rental property subject to federal rural rental housing loans to notify tenants, local housing authorities, and Oregon Housing and Community Services of loan maturity date at least 1 year in advance, requires notice to tenants entering rental agreements within a year of loan maturity, specifies notice requirements, and prohibits rent increases for 1 year for failures to comply. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. And this came from a House committee unanimously and off the House floor, 42-17 nays, one excused.
All right, so we've got Representative Leininger and Rob Prash and
Peter Ainley.
Peter Ainley. Wait, how do you spell Ainley?
H-A-I-N-L-E-Y.
She looks familiar. I've seen you somewhere before.
Representative Leininger.
Usually she has a cloud around her.
Right? Please welcome to our committee. We ask questions.
Members of the committee, I'm Ann Leininger, representing House District 38, and I'm pleased to be here on behalf of House Bill 2629. What it would do is help protect tenants in deeply affordable apartments around the state of Oregon. There are about 200 properties like this in the state of Oregon, and they have mortgage subsidies that cause the mortgage finance costs to be extremely low, and they also get monthly rent subsidies from the federal government. But when the mortgage matures, the rent subsidies from the federal government stops, and so the tenants, often seniors or people with disabilities who make less than 30% of median income, those people are in a really difficult spot, because if they can no longer get that rent subsidy, they may not be able to stay in that housing, and it's not a portable rent subsidy. So they can't just take it and go to some other housing. So this bill would try to address the issue by giving 12 months advance notice. It would require the owner of the property to give the tenants and also the local housing authority and Oregon Housing and Community Services 12 months advance notice before maturity of the mortgage, recognizing again that that's the trigger when the federal rent subsidies stop to these individuals, so that they can find alternate accommodations. And this also makes it possible for a local nonprofit or local housing authority to potentially try to, you know, take over the project through a willing buyer-seller transaction and find some new form of rent subsidy that might be able to keep the tenants in their place. I want to note two things that I think are very important. We worked very closely with the Realtors Association to make sure that they were comfortable with the bill. And when we presented in the House Human Services Committee, a representative of the Realtors was able to come and affirmatively state that they were neutral on the bill. And Sean Gillians could not be here today, but he has authorized me to state that the Realtors Association is neutral on the bill based on the work we did together. For example, by taking out the emergency clause was one of the steps to make sure that people have enough advance notice, that owners have enough advance notice, that the realtors were not concerned about this. I also want to emphasize that this subsidy is not portable. So there was some concern on the House floor, which is why we got some number of no votes, even though we had none in committee, that perhaps 12 months of advance notice would cause the very low-income tenants to go someplace else and carry a rent subsidy with them, and then the landlord would be there trying to fill apartments and cover a mortgage during that window. But the subsidy from the federal government is not portable, so the tenant can't go and take the subsidy with them to some other housing. So that risk is not a risk, which is, I think, one reason why the realtors were comfortable, and I hope will help everyone to be comfortable here. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Leininger, for introducing the bill. My name is Rob Presch. I'm with the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. Since 1963, USDA Rural Development has financed approximately 16,000 rental housing projects through their multifamily housing programs. Most of these properties already, as Representative Leininger mentioned, have project-based rental assistance associated with them. That allows them to house the lowest income households. Over the next 10 years, RD estimates that as many as 75% of these properties will make the final mortgage payments. And when that occurs, all the use restrictions expire and the property just becomes an unrestricted market rate property. And again, the rental assistance is also terminated, and the residents overnight become responsible for the entire rent and utility payment. Currently, there's no law requiring owners notify their residents of the loss of their rental assistance. So what this bill would do is require that owners provide that notice to the residents to protect them from unanticipated rent increases just by simply informing them what's coming. It would provide residents a modest amount of time to try to find other assisted housing. It would also help owners avoid costly and disruptive evictions because their tenants suddenly can't pay their rent because the subsidy payments were cut off. Communities where these properties are located will also be informed of the approaching loss of this resource in their area and would be able to participate in efforts to preserve the property or help their residents find alternate affordable housing. Now, once the owner provides the required notice, they have no further obligation. Should an owner fail to provide the notice, this bill provides very modest tenant protections. House Bill 2629 won't solve this problem. This is a federal government problem, but it should provide a little bit of relief and some soften the impact on the residents. And it may also help preserve some of these properties that may otherwise be lost. And as Representative Leininger noted, we did work with the Oregon Association of Realtors, and the Dash 5 amendment made it clear that this bill does not supersede an owner's legal right to initiate a for-cause eviction during the period of time that the resident is protected. So thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I take any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley, Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, CASA of Oregon. I've submitted some testimony in OLIS. CASA has been working with nonprofits and housing authorities across the state to preserve rental affordable housing, And a lot of these units are USDA subsidized. And we've been working on a project down in Merrill, which is currently subject to this maturing mortgage issue. We'd like to be able to preserve as many of these as we can, and the Oregon Housing Community Services has been providing money to help us do that. When we can preserve these things, we can preserve the rental assistance and keep these people stable. I would just ask and urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? None? Excellent job. Thank you very much. It's a really good bill. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2629? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2629. Colleagues, are you comfortable moving this one today? Are you good? Do we have our paperwork? Are we ready to go?
We do. Senator Cruz is in the hallway at the moment.
But we got it. Let's do it.
Let's do it. We can always add him.
Yeah, we can add him. We can add him later. All right. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2629.
There's no amendments, right?
There's no amendments.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2629A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2629A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and Representative Cruz, Senator Cruz is excused. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2629A. Who would like to carry this one?
I'll carry it.
All right, Senator Olson will carry this one.
I screwed up today. I might as well screw up tomorrow.
All right. So next we are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2578.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2578 provides for termination of residential cable and telecommunication service contracts with a deceased individual or an individual in hospice care without penalty, allows the service provider to require documentation of the death or hospice care, and authorizes a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for violations. This came out of House Committee and on the House floor unanimously, has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right, Representative Bernhardt, and does Jeff Bissonnet want to come up too?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. This is a bill that I brought first, I think, a couple of years ago as a result of a situation that arose in my district involving someone who did go into hospice care and had difficulties dealing with some of these contracts that were for ongoing services. The bill started out as a fairly complicated bill, and as it as the questions came up in the House committee, it slowly worked its way, mostly through the good offices of Mr. Kosasan, into the bill that you see in front of you. Basically, all this bill does is say that that cable service companies and telecommunications companies for residential service will terminate their requirement for an ongoing contract in the event that the person who they have the contract with dies or goes into a hospice program. It allows them to ask for documentation to establish that those things are true. There's no specification of what that documentation is, but of course all hospice programs in Oregon are licensed, so if they wrote a note on their letterhead, that would probably be sufficient. It also adds the $1,000 civil penalty, which I'm assured will probably never be assessed, because companies that learn that this bill is in effect, or this law is in effect, and that someone qualifies under it, would very likely want to comply immediately rather than face the possibility of a fine. So we think it's a very simple bill at this point. We think it's ready. So far as I know, with the answers to the questions I've just given you, there isn't any opposition to the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Bissonnet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnet with the Citizens Utility Board, and we represent residential ratepayers. This is a good bill, consumer protection bill, helping consumers who are in pretty unique circumstances. Good bill, should pass. We urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
Yes, I do.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Good bill, very good bill, but just a little question that I have. As written in subsection 3 of section 2, it would allow a provider of the specific service to simply ask for a formal document from the licensed hospice program that the individual is in the provider's care. Why couldn't they just go to the Oregon Health Authority, because Oregon Health Authority already has all the documentation?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to it. I think the way in which I think this is likely to come up is that somebody connected with the person in hospice care is going to say, well, we have this cell phone contract that needs to be dealt with. The hospice care at that point has a checklist. This is on the checklist. It's a simple thing for them to execute it.
Follow up? I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the question is the service provider wants to make certain that the person was there in care and has died. And
actually, it doesn't require that.
Doesn't require that.
No, the bill is either or. Hospice care generally doesn't occur until a person is terminally ill, and we're talking about the last few weeks of life.
Okay.
So it's a... In some senses, it's not quite a question of semantics, but it's pretty close.
Okay. So either they're in hospice care and they need to terminate their cell phone because they're not going to need it where they're going, or they've already died and the family wants to terminate it.
Correct.
But once again, OHA, Oregon Health Authority, has the authority to provide penalties. So they'd also have the information that the person was there. Wouldn't it be just easier for the service provider to go to OHA and say, wasn't this person in hospice?
I think that, if I could, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and I almost made that mistake too. I think the main issue here is the fiscal issue. If the Oregon Health Authority has to deal with the civil penalties, which are never going to arise, there's no fiscal. If instead they have to deal with requests from the hospice care, which they then forward to the provider, now we have a fiscal on the bill, and suddenly the route through the legislature becomes more complex, and it results in state expenditures that are probably not necessary. If the hospice care takes care of this item as part of their normal social work activity for a person who's dying, then the state doesn't incur any expense.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any further questions? Nope. Seeing none.
I missed Representative Barnhart's testimony, I feel. Could you do it all over again, Phil? That would
Repeat.
Be helpful.
And I'd like to thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. You're very welcome, Senator. Thank you for the question.
I appreciate your good questions. Are there, so do you, Senator Cruz. Any further discussion?
I did read the bill. It makes sense to me. Okay. So.
Very good. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578. Are people okay with moving this bill today?
Yeah, sure.
Right. I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2578.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2578A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2578A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Who'd like to carry this one?
I will.
Senator Cruz will carry
my good friend, Representative.
Senator Cruz will carry this bill.
Fantastic. You got me today.
And then should we suspend the rules to let Senator Olson or Senator Cruz vote?
On
2629?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Vice Chair Olson, would you?
Yes, I move that we suspended the rules to allow a vote from Senator Cruz on 2629.
Yeah. Senator Olson moves that the rules be suspended and that Senator Cruz be allowed to vote on House Bill 2629A. It won't change the outcome. Is there any objection? Nope. So ordered. Senator Cruz, how would you like to vote?
I would like to vote yes.
All right. Please record that vote and we will close that reopened work session on House Bill 2629A and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3257.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3257 extends a sunset on collection of certain monies from electric companies or Oregon Community Power for purposes related to low-income electric bill payment assistance from January 2nd, 2016, extended to January 2nd, 2018, declares emergency effective on passage. This is another unanimous measure out of House Committee and off the House floor. There's a revenue statement, and it is at the dais. No fiscal impact and no subsequent referral.
And there is also testimony in OLIS from Ryan Fisher, who had to leave. So I'll invite Jeff Bissonette back up, and Varner Seaman, and Elizabeth Howe. Isn't it nice that the House has so many unanimous bills?
Well, so do we.
So do we.
We do. We all get along well here.
Sometimes.
Except when we don't.
Good point.
Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here speaking on behalf of PG to testify in favor of HB 3257. Let me give a short description of what the bill does. In 2011, the state of Oregon passed legislation for the customers of PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric to put a per-meter charge on folks' electric bill that raised some additional funds to the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, which is the state-run program that raises money for low-income bill payment assistance. The money is collected by utilities, routed through Oregon Housing Community Services, and administered by community action agencies here in the state on behalf of customers of the two investor-owned utilities to help folks who are having a hard time paying their bill. This program was extended in 2013, and this would be the third extension of this program for a two-year period of time. What we have seen over time is that the number of folks who need assistance in paying their bill far exceeds the available source of both federal and state funds, or federal funds in the form of low-income LIHEAP dollars, and then collected from residential ratepayers, from utility ratepayers, money in terms of the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, or OEAP, that we're talking about here today. For PGE, we are able to serve about one-fifth of the folks who qualify for assistance in our service territory. This is helpful to have these funds, but by no means deals with the totality of the challenge in terms of complete funding for folks who are having a hard time paying their bills. We think that these types of programs, which are on the front end, where people are struggling to get people some assistance and to get people into services where they can hopefully get in front of struggling to pay their bills, we think this is much more efficient for both the customers affected and the system overall than having people having their power shut off and then having to go back out and turn their power back on. The reason why this is only a two-year extension as opposed to a longer extension is that there, we think, is some important ongoing work at the Oregon Public Utilities Commission to look at what the proper way should be for the state to structure our low-income payment assistance programs. Is something we look forward to working with Citizens Utility Board, folks at the PUC, and some of the other stakeholders that they're concerned about these issues. Again, we don't think this solves the challenge of people having a hard time paying their utility bills, but we think it's a step in the right direction. This has been a bipartisan program in the past. In 2013, when the bill was extended, it was supported by both Mike McClain and Speaker Kotak. We saw pretty strong bipartisan support in the House side, in the House Energy Environment Committee, and as noted, passed unanimously out of committee, passed unanimously on the House floor. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and we encourage you to support the program. Happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I'm here representing Pacific Power. Pacific Power serves about 560,000 customers, primarily in rural parts of the state. So Varner covered most of what you need to know today, but I'll just add that rural parts of the state, as our rural members really know, is lagging behind in the economic recovery. And so we are still seeing a tremendous need for bill payment assistance in our service territory. And this is a great program not only for keeping service going to people so they don't get shut off and all that that means for their family. But they are also, through our customer service representatives, often connected with other services that they are available to them, whether it's the SNAP program or other financial assistance if they're in hardship. And so that's another benefit that our customers see from having a proactive opportunity to reach out to them to try to keep their power on. So with that, we would also encourage you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Jeff Bissonette for the Citizens Utility Board representing residential ratepayers. Here also to echo support for the bill and reinforce the comments you just heard from the utilities, not in something you hear every day. The only thing I'd note is that the extension of the additional money the $5 million that gets us to $20 million, it comes directly from residential ratepayers. The base money, the $15, is a system cost, and we think that overall that's a better way to do that. But because of the economic needs, we are agreeing to continue the residential ratepayers paying the extra, and because the PUC has a more extensive discussion underway on how to do bill payment assistance overall, we figure that's the place to take our concerns, and so we'll be doing that, and you may be hearing more about that once we come to the conclusion of that discussion. So with that, please do support House Bill 3257, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Senator Dimbrough?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I do support this, but I wonder why we have to keep doing it in two-year increments, that this program is.
Madam Chair, Senator Dimbrough, this issue basically came up in the depths of the Great Recession, to sort of move the issue along, we said, let's do 2 years because the money is really needed. It would have been a more extensive conversation with the commercial customers, and then. 2 years, and we figured 2 years would kind of get us through the roughest part of the recession. 2 years later, the economy was still struggling, and so let's do it again. And now we're at a point where we are having a larger conversation, but rather than have the money go from $20 million back down to $15 million, let's extend it for another 2 years and see what the permanent solution is. And so it's our hope to get out of the 2 year extension. We're on record as being in support of making the $20 million permanent, but if we did that, we would like to have it as a system cost. That said, the PUC process might come up with a different solution, a different program structure. So, again, rather than have the argument, we'll have the discussion, or rather than having a discussion here, we'll have a discussion over at the PUC and come up with a longer-term solution.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
What are the costs of ratepayers?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, the cost of ratepayers is 25 cents.
So,
for this bill, 3257.
Yeah, well, overall.
For
the $15 million that they have to pay every year.
Well, so the totality. So there are a couple of different Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, for. Let me go back and do a little bit better explanation of the legislative history. In 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1149, which was the partial energy deregulation bill that created the public purpose charge. That established a 3% charge on folks' bills for all customers' bills. And a portion of that money goes to low-income bill payment assistance. So collected from commercial customers, residential customers, and industrial customers, in totality, that raises between PGE and PacifiCorp $15 million a year as a 3% surcharge. So for me as a PGE customer, on my monthly bill, that would be
So actually, in due respect to my colleague from PGE, the public purpose charge is separate from the energy assistance charge. So public purpose charge is separate for the energy assistance charge. For the base $15 million, it's a it's about 52 cents, 53 cents, something like that, on a residential customer's charge. For a commercial customer, it's a cents per kilowatt charge, and for industrial customers, it's also a cents per kilowatt hour charge, and the industrial customers are capped at $500 a meter. That's kind of the spread for the base 15. For adding the $20 million, it gets the residential customer charge to about between 80 and 85 cents a month, and again doesn't change the per kilowatt hour charge on the commercial side, doesn't change the cap on the industrial side.
So this collection of this money, does this strictly go to PGE PacifiCorp customers, or does it go throughout the state?
Just to PGE and PacifiCorp customers, and it's only assessed on the customers of PGE and PacifiCorp.
So once again, we have an inequitable tax program here where people that live right across the street from here on Canby Utility Board don't pay this fee that I have to pay, so I'm taxed inordinately. Because of that, that's the point I want to make.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, actually, first, I want to thank Mr. Bissonnette for his helping me out in terms of the explanation of it. As we look at this issue in terms of our rate making, the way that we consider these charges is essentially there's no difference to us as a utility in terms of do we help people pay their bills or do we shut off their bills and put it into arrearage and potentially write it off as bad debt. What we see is that for the customers, there's a pretty big inefficiency if we don't have these types of programs in place where people have to go through shutoffs. Now, these are the programs that are regulated by the state and passed by statute for the investor-owned utilities. For publicly owned utilities, they have their own set of programs which are separate from these and are not regulated by the state because they have got local control and their own boards do these. Do low-income bill payment assistance programs. There's a program that's going to, or a bill that's going to be up in front of you in a few weeks, 2599, HB 2599, also talking about low-income issues and about bill shutoffs. What we saw on the House side when the bill was up in committee on the House side, folks from Public Power came forward and talked quite a bit about the programs that they have. So I think this is the type of situation where we have a program. The public power providers also have programs. Our programs are required to be enacted by statute. Those folks don't require statute. So I think that we have some rough equivalency in terms of how the programs that both have programs. This only applies to us, given that we've got a different regulatory structure.
Thank you. I want to make one comment.
Sure.
To my colleagues, this shows that our economy isn't doing what it should be doing, because we have so many people and so much dire straits. We need to fix that.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I just want to back that up, because I know that like Douglas Electric and Douglas County has a similar program that runs kind of parallel, and I think most of them kind of match. So I don't think there's a lot of inequities in the system between the two. So
thank you all very much. Any further questions or discussion? Are you all okay moving the bill today?
Sure.
All right. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3257 and open a work session on House Bill 3257.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 3257A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3257A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Mina Sanderson, would you carry this one?
Thank you. Please. I will.
Thank you very much. We close the work session on House Bill 3257, and we have, in the words of Representative Barnhart, exhausted our agenda. So we are at our agenda. So we are of Representative Barnhart.